Well, I'm happy to be here this evening, and I say that honestly. I think a lot of other places I might be, it wouldn't be nearly so delightful. I could be home working. Or I could be growling at my son, who wasn't feeling well today, and occupied the couch with his full 260 pounds, thereby wearing out in the middle and on the side at the same time. So there are a lot of places I could be that would be less happy than this particular circumstance, so I'm glad to be here tonight. And while I'm not really a true literary person, I've always enjoyed these Ibri situations. They allow me to expand and do things I couldn't do otherwise. I always feel a little guilty. I do make about half Ibri meetings. The other half I don't make. I'm doing something else. Elders meetings are often on Tuesday night, and that is a shot night right from the start. Those who have had an experience have been saved a certain amount of travail of a lesser sort, so I won't say anything more about it. But I'm glad to be with you. In past years, I've looked at I've looked at Solzhenitsyn, I've looked at Potok, and I've looked at Bernard Ram, last year at J.B. Phillips, and a bunch of other guys over the last 8 or 9 years. So you'd think I'd be a lot wiser by now, but wisdom comes from taking in, not giving out. So I maybe haven't improved all that much. Well, here's a pretty good example of Christian satire taken out of Miller's Philippian fragment, which I will come to it later, one way or another. Ah, there they are, fellas. But here's a pretty good example of Christian satire, just in an introductory sense. This is a purported letter of just about 300 AD, during the persecutions of Diocletian, relates the conversion of Crunus Scunus. It is certain now that all the lions are gone. First wave of persecution is over, and we are enjoying a new period of peace and security. But security is never the friend of faith. It is peril that produces steadfastness. When the church is secure, she gains too many freedoms. She enjoys her freedoms to doubt, the freedom to major and minor issues, and the freedom to indulge herself in community acceptance. The most ghastly freedom of all is the freedom from the utter dependency she must have to weather the crisis. Since the lions are gone, the people are speaking openly of being born again. Even the mayor of Philippi is speaking unguardedly of being born again. And while these pagans have no idea what the term really means, they are sure that it has some connection with Christianity. Others in our community are printing the words in their togas, born again, and try God. I tell you, Clement, it all started when they took the lions to Rome. You may be sure that when they bring them back, there will be much less open talk and toga signs. But now we are into it, it's almost a fad. Some of the local actors are also saying that they have been born again. One of the tragedians in the Greek theater says he will never again do Greek tragedy. His joy is so great. He is going to become a joyous comedian and act in thousands of theaters to the joy of Christ who has saved him. He is born again. But the most notable conversion has been that of Crunus Scunus. Yes, that is right. He too is born again. It all happened when his hairdresser, who is a member of our church, stuck a sculpture torchment in his shiny toga telling him how to be born again. And thus it happened. He was famous before for his homespun ballads like Back Home in Roma and Nighty Nighty Aphrodite. But he is through crooning that he found his thrill on Palatine Hill. Now he is born again and he intends to give his entire life to singing songs and traditions of the church. He has a stunning new composition called Please Jesus, Just Seize Us and Heal Our Diseases. Well, that is how it goes when one is born again. How authentic Brother Swoonus is would be difficult to say. I know he means well, but there were numerous rumors that his singing career was about over when he had the good fortune to be born again. There was something about his deportment that suggested the good fortune was really all God's, and that the Almighty was certainly lucky that the golden throat once given to the world is now committed unto God. I suppose it was God's lucky day, all right. At least the amphitheater is being packed after night and night to hear Crunus lay him in the aisle for Jesus. A single verse from his big hit musical Testimony will tell you more than I can. I've been set completely free since the man of Galilee died on the cross for me. Yea, yea, yea. Deaf and mute, I had no sight. Life for me was just a fright till I stumbled into light. Yea, yea, yea. Now I'm giving up my sin. Love commandments 1 through 10. Praise the Lamb, I'm born again. Yea, yea, yea. As you can see, Clement, this song is not quite up to the one the beasts and the elders sing in the Apocalypse. In the interest of Christian art, it might be better to have the lions back. Well, that's an introduction to a satire which has Christian overtones to it. And some people love it, and some people hate it. That's the way it goes with lots of other things in life, too. There are people who don't like cheesecake, and people who can gobble it by the tongue. I've always enjoyed satire because it appeals maybe to the baser man. I don't know. but it appeals to me, and I've kind of enjoyed it. At the same time, I felt that satirists and fantasy people can do an awful lot of harm if they're not judicious and careful with what they do. So I thought that this concept of Ivrea, I would talk with you about satire and fantasy in the writings of Swift and Miller, more in Miller than in Swift, because Miller is alive and writing today, and Swift has departed a long time ago. And these few lines I read were from the Philippian fragment, which is full of about 120 more pages, very similar to that, along other different lines, in which he alternately makes fun of something, and on the other hand, preaches a sermon about something. He comes and goes. I offer some introductory remarks on these pages that I put before you. If anyone thinks I'm going to read them line for line, they're badly mistaken. That's why I print them out, so I can just hand them out. Ivrea tends to serve the purpose of giving people of academic demeanor an opportunity to swap their opinions back and forth. If that is not sufficiently obscure, you'll have to ask Dr. Peterson or Dr. Newman or somebody else later on. It really is nice to have a circle of friends where you can discuss things in a little more prolific or proficient fashion than you might on the local bus or even in Sunday school. I don't despise either, but it's kind of nice, and so Ivrea does that. And you'll see all sorts of strange talks being given in Ivrea. I work in literature because I don't know anything about science. I'm not nearly good enough with the text to work on all of those things. So, and Mr. Packle lectured on library science last year, and I can hardly find the books. So obviously I don't work in that particular thrust. But Ivrea has that purpose, and it's a very nice purpose of giving us some academic involvement beyond just the classroom. If we could cut it down to just six of us drinking a great quantity of something that was reasonably good to drink, I gave up coffee 6.5 years ago, but if we could break it down to a small group, then we could have a much greater and more intense interchange of opinions. As this the last few Ivreas I've been through, somebody lectures like I'm doing now, occasionally takes a question, often it's a profound discussion, everybody starts looking numb, and they've been stoned to death, and they're anxious to get down to refreshments anyhow, so that's the way it's kind of gone. But those are the purposes of Ivrea, and those purposes are served well. And I put together this study because of the great amount of fantasy literature there is out today and because of my personal enjoyment of satire. If you're not aware of the amount of fantasy literature, you just don't go to the bookstore, both Christian bookstores and bookstores of a secular sort, of course. But Christian authors like John White are abounding in fantasy today. This kind of pours out because fantasy catches the imagination and lets you escape from the hard chair you're sitting in and move off into another kingdom. So there's a great deal of it today. How well these two things serve the Lord's testimony is part of the question I look at tonight. I don't think I'll solve it, but it's part of the question I look at tonight. And of course, my hope is that in time to come, we will see more literature produced that will be really effective in alerting people to the needs of the world and the problems of society and the cause of the gospel. That's kind of my hope in this thing. And when I get to page 6, where we'll get eventually, I just ask whether you're thinking Jonathan Swift would write if he knew about the abortion problems of today, and what sort of trenchant literature would come from his pen to make people crawl on the ground in the face of their sin. And we don't see enough of it, I think, and maybe that's because we don't read really enough, too. I offer some definitions of satire. I don't think I need to go over that. The one thing that has to be true of satire is that the humor element must be apparent. If the humor element is not apparent, then you've got invective or cursing or something like that. That's the big thing. The literary genre takes the reactions of amusement or dismay. So we present something for you like these things with regard to crueness. That's one of the milder counts in this book, incidentally. Some people are filled with dismay, and other people are filled with amusement. But the author has picked up an incongruous element in the Christian community. He's put up for you to see, and some say, oh my, and others say, oh, they chuckle in derision or something. But the idea of the satirist is to draw a picture so humorously grotesque that you've got to look at it and you've got to say what should be done about that. That's the idea of the satirist. And the ability with which he does that and the degree to which he's successful will determine a great deal of the degree of his ability as a satirist. I mentioned things that it may include, which I shan't go over, I think. I just mentioned the simple definitions. But it's got to have humor apparent. It doesn't have to be slapstick humor. It can be witty humor, crude humor, vulgar humor, but it's got to have humor apparent because it's humor that makes satire work. Satire is different than looking at somebody and calling him a bunch of bad names. Satire is calling him a number of names that will make people laugh or feel some apathy for his particular circumstance. And I don't mean calling names in a vulgar way. I mean calling them by certain circumstances and distinctions. Fantasy. Now, here's a bad point in my notes. Well, everybody who's with me in school knows I make bad points. I started to type the definition of fantasy on the bottom of page 1, got it wrong, That's how the computer helps you a lot. So then I typed it right, and when I printed it, my both definitions came out. So the real definition of fantasy is on the top of two, not on the bottom of one. That's where it is. It's a form of allegory, in my opinion. Literary scholars don't all agree on that, or didn't when I was taking this stuff. And I think that's still pretty much true. But more particularly, it's a literary genre of transport. Fantasy moves you into another world. And so here you are reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's fantasy. So you're not for the moment thinking of the television, the icebox, and the dinner table. You're moved into another world. And fantasy, as satire is more successful as it makes the grotesque stand out humorously, fantasy is more successful the more it removes you from where you are. I remember reading Tolkien's Lord of the Rings some years ago. I had read The Hobbit prior to that. I enjoyed The Hobbit enormously, but I could put it down rather easily. After all, a hero with fur on his feet. What can you say? What can you say for him? So I enjoyed it enormously, but I didn't have that compulsion to put it down because its world was not, somehow it wasn't really my world. No fantasy world is, but the fantasy is a world of transport. When I began reading The Lord of the Rings, all at once I was there. I was there. It's by the same author, following the same plot, but a different dimension. So fantasy is a form of allegory that moves you into another world where paradoxically it's really discussing your present world. I mentioned on page 2 that all writers of fantasy deny that they're allegorizing. That's the standard thing. Tolkien says it, Swift said it, they all deny it. We're just telling a nice pleasant story here. The fact that it touches on issues of life just as you know them, that doesn't really mean anything. I remember that circumstance in the Ring trilogy where the friends are all looking at the well of Galadriel or the mirror of Galadriel and wondering what they can do next, and somebody says he says why it is that our greatest opportunity that they find the smallest things to send them apart and tear up their confederacy. I said to myself, and that sounds like churches I have known and other things I have known too. So I mentioned that in a general sense. Satire is the ability to portray the grotesque in a way that fills you with some type of emotion, either revulsion or amusement, but some emotion that says we ought to do something about that. And fantasy is the ability to move you into an ethereal state, not soul transfer, as I'll say later, but move you into an ethereal state so that in that state you see lessons about where you now are. And that's a striking kind of a situation. You can see it in Alice in Wonderland. That's hardly Christian fantasy. But the difference between fantasy writers, Christians and non-Christians, is chiefly that the Christian writers try to make some ethereal comparisons to spiritual values. In Calvin Miller's trilogy on The Singer, The Song, and The Finale, he talks about Earthmaker. You don't have to be a genius to know who Earthmaker is, do you? You don't have to be a genius to know that. He talks about the invader who comes in and takes over your soul. See, those are all borrowed theological concepts brought into his narrative and into his allegory. Now, if you are reading it from a non-Christian point of view, you might read the whole allegory 10 times and not have any idea what was really going on. So the concept in the fantasy is to put you into another world and make you think of this world. And the better the fantasy writers can do that, the more success they have in what they're doing. I offer a few notes on the history of satire, which I think I felt obligated to put down, but I don't feel obligated to say very much about. Satire as an art undoubtedly originated in Greece. As a discipline, it developed in Rome. But it undoubtedly originated in Greece and probably came to its climax with the plays of Aristophanes, which are enormously satirical. Now, the Roman satirist Homer is the first really good satirist that we know of. There are others before him. I don't remember their names and didn't feel like I ought to write them all down. Horace I've known for years. Horace writes nice poems, satirical poems. Points out the grotesque features. When I mean grotesque, I mean out of the ordinary features of his political opponents. Makes fun of them along those lines. The Roman satirist Persius began to use it as a teaching medium. He would come up with a little epigram at the end of a satire or a little motto to teach something in a didactic sense. Kind of like Aesop does with the fables, come up with some little message like that. Juvenal, the Roman satirist, was famous for really barbarous satire, I would say. I haven't read all of these fellows totally. I've read a little of all of them. The Juvenile was famous for barbarous satire, the kind of satire that made people want to go out and shoot themselves. Petronius adopted, Petronius and a couple of other fellows, adopted the satire to a longer form, not now just poems or essays, but the long romantic forms, in which they brought in fabled people from the East in a romantic guise, and then actually made fun of things in Rome through making puns of those persons. I'm going to be on sabbatical the next 3 months here. I have every week for a long time edited a thing published in a student body known as Taylor's Weekly. I give it out freely because nobody would pay for it anyway. So I just give it out every week, and I've enjoyed doing it. It carries announcements and other stuff in it, sometimes serious stuff, sometimes stupid stuff, and sometimes stuff that shouldn't be printed. You know, it's one you can't always predict it, but I'm going to be gone for 3 months, and Taylor's Weekly will not be published during those 3 months, as the Weekly would be. However, one night I was watching The Muppet Show. Anybody seen The Muppets? And The Pigs. Anybody seen Pigs in Space lately? Pigs in Space? Well, The Pigs in Space were visiting the planet Coosbane. And I said, boy, I said, there would be a nice place to go in my sabbatical, to the planet Coosbane. And I said, then I could write letters back and tell the guys in school what I'm doing and what I'm learning and how the sabbatical is going. So the Weekly is not going to be printed regularly, but there are going to be communiques from the planet Coosbane and other places. And they'll be somewhat satirical, I think, because, you know, when you order a meal on the planet Coosbane, it first has to go through the dietetic committee and then through the chef's committee. Not. Nice satire, maybe. Maybe my wife will look at it and say, drop this whole idea. We'll wait and see. But friendly sorts of stuff. But that's what they did with Petronius, told a long story. A lot of us who suffered through English Lit will remember Piers the Plowman, which is a satire on the wretched life of the English clergy and their unbelievable ignorance. In church history, we always run the fellows through the recognition of von Hutten with his Letters of Obscure Men, written with other letters to defend Johann Reuchlin, the German lover of Hebrew. They were satirical things in which he would take some opponent of Reuchlin's and write a letter and make himself sound as dumb as possible. I heard a lady arguing for homeschooling on the radio the other day. I'm not opposed to it. If you like it, good. But this lady was telling how she was teaching her children at home and how they were learning so much more than they did in the regular school. And she says, you know, she says, I seen my girl come in the door. And when she come in, I said to her, that's almost word for word. And I said, well, you may be able to teach her geology and botany, but you're not going to teach her English. I said, that child's going to get somewhere and she's going to say, I went and seen it, Mama. And it's not like it ought to be. So whatever the case might be. Von Hutten's letters did that to the men who he ascribed them to. In the more modern period, we had Samuel Butler with a famous satirist called Hudibras, which is kind of like a British Don Quixote, making fun of hypocrisy and things in the ecclesiastical life that he didn't like. And from the Spanish literature, Don Quixote is maybe one of the most allegorical, satirical novels of all time in some ways. I've just enjoyed Don Quixote. You know, almost anything he does always interested me. But those of us who remember easily see him tilting the windmills and charging up and freeing the prisoners. The prisoners are being transported to another jail, but Quixote comes up and rescues them all, sets them free to prey on society again in his attempt to do good. And, of course, Cervantes is spoofing the aristocratic nature of the Spain of his day. And in America, James Russell Lowell put out some things in New England dialect, the Biglow Papers, which are enormously satirical with big moral overtones. In the present day world, the most famous ecclesiastical satirist for a good while was Simeon Stylites in the Christian Century. For many, many years, that was a liberal publication, but you had to be an adult not to enjoy Simeon from time to time. I remember when they were looking for a symbol for the World Council of Churches, Simeon said, why not select the duck? Why not select the duck, he said. He said, the duck floats on the surface of the water, absolutely unconcerned for what goes on underneath him, above him, or around him. He said, why not select the duck? It was at a time, mind you, he's a liberal, but it was a time when they were facing different things, and he was spoofing the ecumenical bodies for not taking active concerns. So he said, the duck. And he described how the duck paddled his feet. It made him think of some bishops who sat in their chairs. And on he went. Now, there was an attempt to respond to him in Christianity Today with Eutychus, the Letters of Eutychus. And under some of the Eutychus writers, they were pretty clever. Then under some of the Eutychus writers, I would say they were just pretty dumb. But that's my passing view of those things. Well, we come then down to this observation that satire at times has been a really sharp sword. Honestly, some people have been provoked to self-destruction by it. And sometimes it's been an attack to really praise and to promote things in a very big sense. It depends on how successful a satirist is and whose side he's on. If he's with you, you love him. If he's against you, it can be pretty tough. I will say that if a man is a gifted satirist, it is a mistake to argue with him because he will invariably, it's like those pictures that show the little kid really beating up the bully. You know, in real life, that just doesn't happen. Once in a while, a little kid has a big brother that comes and clubs him, but believe me, I took swings at bullies many times, and all I got out of it was a battered nose or other parts of my physiognomy. I'm not saying it never happens, but it doesn't happen very often. And consequently, that's how it goes with satire. The best way to compete or to treat with a satirist is to just absolutely ignore him. You know, don't burn his books. He'll write a book on that. Just ignore him. They don't go away, but they don't have nearly as much influence that way. Sometimes they're hard to ignore. Well, the two authors that I'm looking at tonight are Jonathan Swift and Calvin Miller. Jonathan Swift died in 1745 after a seven-year illness. The last 3 years of his life, he was not mentally competent. He had suffered all of his life from Meniere's disease. Do you know what Meniere's disease is? All of his life, that inner ear canal disease, which at times makes you lose balance. He suffered from that. And when in about 1742, he suffered a paralytic stroke, and he was virtually bedfast for the last 2.5 years of his life. Had trustees pressed to his estate and whatnot. At times he would have moments where he understood things. Other times he was non-compos mentis or something like that. But in his day, he was the foremost prose satirist in the English language, the Britannica says. Professor Oda says he's the greatest English prose satirist of all time. I had about several of these quotes, and when they all said about the same thing, I figured two of them would be enough. I can't say much about his life in this short time, but his father died before he was born. His father died a month before he was born, and he was raised in the home of an uncle, whom I think attempted to take good care of him. But, you know, there's too much competition for a little income in a home like that. And although Swift was given a reasonable education, he always kind of felt ignored in the process of life. Swift had what the modern fellows today would call a very low self-image. Very low self-image. And he was quite sure of what he was doing, but always felt that he didn't get the shape he should have had. And consequently, he had that I've been beaten again sort of attitude on life. And without going into details about it, he changed politics in England to join the Tories after 1700. That made the people back, he was born in Ireland, did I mention that? It made the people in Ireland think that he was his own party, not really with them. He took a lot of abuse from it. But in England, he was a popular satirist and pamphleteer. He wrote for the Tatler and all of those fascinating magazines and did his party great service. And he irritated Queen Anne somehow. And when he thought he would be appointed Bishop of Ireland or Archbishop of Ireland, instead he was given the position of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin as dean. And he was sent there in 1713 and spent the rest of his life working in that connection. He came to England from time to time. Swift was always disappointed in that. Felt that he had not been dealt fairly with by the church or by the queen. The queen felt that he had snipped at her once too often, although he felt he never had. See, a satirist has to be very careful because he can snip people who he doesn't mean to snip. You know, if you snip the ones you want to snip, then they know they're snipped. But if you snip your friends and they don't know you didn't want to snip them, the snip is even twice as painful. So the queen felt he had really hit her at the church pretty hard in England, and so she gave him this position at the Ireland. And one of my books on Swift says that he regarded Ireland as a good place to die in and a wonderful place to live away from. But as Dean of St. Patrick's, he took a great interest in the Irish problem, which was big then as it has been before and since, and a tremendous interest in the social circumstances of the Irish problem, and really worked hard for Ireland. He became a national hero. They gave a great, 4 years before he died, they gave a great national celebration in his honor. He became a national hero. He spoke for the Irish so much. You know, he could look around, he could say, the Irish are like pigs, but the English ought to feed them. And the Irish would say, yay! It's a funny thing how he did it. I had a note here on Swift's, on the most famous of all of his things, the Modest Proposal from Preventing the Children of Poor People in Ireland. We usually just call it Swift's Modest Proposal. His modest proposal was that they, or maybe a lot of you have read it, his modest proposal was that they take them and cook them and sell them for food. Up to a year old child. A young, healthy child, well-nursed, is, at a year old, the most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or broiled. And I will no doubt that it will equally serve in a fricassee or a ragu. He suggested that they could pack them in jars and send them to England, and they could be sold as pickled herring or sold. then he notes this is a reason behind this. What he's saying is that the English government is going to be fair in their treatment of Ireland. Might as well take these kids and feed them. He then points out six major advantages of his cannibalistic scheme. Listen to these. It would greatly lessen the number of papists. Are you with that? It would greatly lessen the number of papists. The poorer tenants will have something valuable of their own with which to help pay their landlord's rent. The constant breeders, besides the gain of 8 shillings sterling per annum for the sale of their children, will be rid of the charge of maintaining them after the first year. And thus, this would be a great inducement to marriage and introduce a new dish and delight to the palates of the English. Really, a very, very trenchant satire by Swift on that particular problem. It's often been said of Swift, see, that he just hated people, but he really didn't hate people. He was irritated by institutions and the slowness of them, and he worked with great force against those things. We know him for The Tale of a Tub, which I will mention later, maybe. The Tale of the Tub is Swift's satire on the church, which is split over many petty things and divisions. Some people have thought that Swift was really speaking against all religion, but Swift was a devout religious man and very faithful in the services of the church, and his sermons are really quite worth reading when you have an opportunity to browse any of them. He was a devoutly religious man. But in The Tale of a Tub, he's trying to show the advantages of the Anglican Church over the Catholic Church and over the dissenting church round about. You'll not be surprised when you discover that the men in the tub, one of them is named Peter, one of them is Martin, and one of them is named John. And if you can't quickly see those fellows, then there's not much hope right now. See, Peter, of course, represents the Roman Church. Martin represents the Lutheran-Anglican tradition together, because they are hierarchical in some degree. And John represents Calvin, of course, who stands for the Presbyterians and the Nonconformists, the Congregationalists, and the Puritans. And the attempt in The Tale of the Tub is to show how much better the Anglican Church is than either of those, but in so doing, he has to admit a lot of its faults, and that's what really missed Queen Anne. And she saw that. That was came out in 1704 anonymously, but Swift was quickly identified with it. So he really does a nice job of butchering all parties. Each time, the Anglican party comes out looking a little better, but wounded. It's like going to a battle with a friend and he loses two arms and you only lose one. So it was one of those things that people thought that he was almost being anti-religious, but you know, the whole point in The Tale of the Tub is with these little picky things over whether you bow at this point in the ceremony or stand at that point or bow from the waist with the right hand in front or the left hand in back. All of those things were minute and harmful to the body. I will say nothing more about Swift. I'll talk about Gulliver's Travels maybe in a couple of minutes. But a very, very interesting man. And the author, whose name I didn't write down here, Grubb, an English scholar on Swift, he says, Swift is the incarnate spirit of hypocrisy reversed, all good qualities within and genuine, but some pretty reprehensible ones on the surface. On the surface, it looked like he hardly cared for people, that his whole life was given to people, and a very interesting life it was, too. Calvin Miller is a modern-day satirist. I was reading from his Philippian fragment a few minutes ago. I mentioned here that I feel like I should have met him, but I never have. Sometimes you meet these guys, you don't like them anymore. Sometimes it's better not to meet them. But I haven't. I thought about a lot of things, but I hadn't thought about going to Omaha. He's pastored the same church in Omaha from 1966. During that time, he's written about 20 books. So not all of his time is spent in hospital visitation. But whatever the case is, since 1975, he's turned increasingly to fantasy and satire. In 1975, he came out with The Singer, which is a fantasy on the life of Christ. And then a few years later, he came out with A Song, which is a fantasy on church history. And his final work, The Finale, is a fantasy on the warfare of Armageddon and things that happen at the end of the age. Now, they are all three enormously worth reading if you like to read that kind of stuff. You might as well be honest about that. In Miller's trilogy, a very simple poetry goes with blank verse and direct verse and other forms, too. I enjoyed reading them a great deal. They're not long. You can read either one of them in about an hour with some dedication and just a tiny bit of skill. 2 hours if you're very slow. 3 hours if you have to pronounce every word out loud. They look bigger than they are. He's got the habit of having title pages and blank pages on either side of them and one line pages. So you're looking and say, boy, there's a big book. And you suddenly realize 120 pages boils down to about 60 pages of type. But I enjoyed reading them considerably. He's moved increasingly towards that line. I don't know much how he stands in the present problems in the Southern Baptist Church. I haven't had opportunity to do that. But his satirical works have come forth more lately. The Philippian Fragment and the Valiant Papers are just excellent examples of modern Christian satirical work. The Philippian fragment amuses you more. The Valium papers, I'll talk about them individually later, is a little heavier stuff, but they both strike you in a very powerful sense. So I mentioned that those are the two authors and the two sources I'm looking at with regard to Sartre, satire, and fantasy in our discussion this evening. I note also, see, our library has been growing excellently, but I note also that apart from the edition of Gulliver's Travels and the great literature of the Western world, nothing of Swift or Miller can be found in the library at all. But we will remedy that. We'll cast some used books out of them. You know, you can't have everything. These men are not what you'd call theological models, although their impact in the Christian circle probably outdoes a lot of theologians that I know in terms of the final round of those things. Just a few observations on these and other satirists, generalizations, some of them I copped out of my English lit books, and some I just made up. The ones I made up are the ones that sound dumb. Moral criticism. The satirists always see themselves as big moral critics. They see themselves as critics of society. Not bad. They see some things in society, or in Christianity, in the church, or in the world. They see things that bother them considerably, and so they decide to correct those things by criticism. In general, with a play on words in figure two, in general, they have a greater concept of love of men than love of man as an object. In Swift's particular case, Swift is a great holder to depravity in several lives. In Swift's particular case, he wonders how God can stand man, but he can easily see how God can love men. Is that too much of a paradox or too much of a twist there? So that individuals get great attention, and he thinks the problem with England, and the problem with England is that England loves man but hates men. So they're starving the Irish, he says. And really not, it isn't that he wants welfare for Ireland. He'd like Ireland to govern itself. Does that sound like a strange thing? He'd like the English to leave and govern themselves. Swift says any government that is imposed without the consent of those who are governed is the perfect ideal of slavery, he says. So when he talks about the English-Irish situation, what he really looks at is that, you know, he says that England loves the concept of man and worships it, he says, but doesn't love men. So they can talk big about humanity, but when it comes down to individual men, they can imprison them for nothing. Likewise, I mentioned the ability to spot and identify incongruities. Satirists are good at that. They can pick up a tiny flaw and maybe enlarge it to something. They distrust the establishment. Even the establishment satirist, Swift, really was that. But in their honesty of the problems, they criticize the establishment as much as they do the anti-establishment. You understand what I'm saying there? They are not propagandists writing to defend a political position. They are men who see a social or a spiritual problem, and they try to deal with it. Their satire is naturally aimed chiefly at the opposition, but they are aware of the fact that no party is perfect. So they wind up spoofing everybody. And in Swift's case, he spoofed Queen Anne, thought it was, he was spoofing her, and that was cost him a big position. They delight in general aims. They often can't deal with specific issues, so they deal with general aims. They'll reform all of society of one particular scope. There are some exceptions to that. But it's a world of ideal and fantasy with general aims. They're all very quick to claim veracity. When you get to the end of Gulliver's Travels, after you go through all these improbable things in Gulliver's Travels, there's a whole chapter over how anyone who takes a journey and writes a lie about it should be hung. a little chapter, 4 or 5 pages. But he starts out by saying, I want to tell you that everything I've said is the truth. And when you read through Gulliver's Travels, the wildest science fiction cannot come up to it for various ideas. He says, I want to tell you everything that's the truth. And people who give travel logs and don't tell the truth ought to be hung. There shouldn't be any time spent for them at all. In the case of Miller, he documents his with historic accounts. This Philippian fragment, after he's gone through all his nonsense, he gives us a long historical account of how he happened to come on it, so we really believe it. And in the Valiant Letters, his historical account is an introduction in the front. So they work to claim veracity. They're not serious about that. You understand. Swift knew better. But they want to impress on the mind of the reader that there's a point there and he ought to get it. Well, that takes me over to page 4, which doesn't have a number on it. But it's still page 4. Where I talk about the fantasy and the modus operandi, how it works. Well, I look quickly at these three particular rags, the Valiant Letters. The Valiant Letters are the account of a guardian angel watching over a man whom soul he's assigned to. Swift, this fellow is quite a heavy Calvinist, too. He's a Southern Baptist, but in many ways a pretty heavy Calvinist. That's a term that I don't even feel like defining tonight. But the angel is guarded over this fellow. who has brought him to the point where he comes into the knowledge of God. He has his doubts if he'll ever make it or not. But he's sure, he feels certain he will, but there are times when he worries about it. He picks him up as an infant, talks about how he'd like to reach out and touch him, but he can't do that because the guardian angel can't exert any physical force on you. All the guardian angel can do is exert moral force. And so when the hero is standing in a bookstore looking at raunchy magazines, he's saying, read the Bible, read the Bible. Or trying to direct him in some more helpful way, the angel is. Miller tells us that these papers came to his hands during an episode too long to discuss here in Cleveland. He found them in the bus terminal of Cleveland, these strange papers that stuck to his hand. He took them back to his hotel room. He was thoroughly tired. When he woke up the next morning, he realized that they were fading. And so he spent the next 24 hours with fever and everything else copying the pages as rapidly as he could. He barely got through before suddenly all the print was gone off all of them, and the message was lost forever. This was the guardian angel's report to the homeland, which is heaven, and addressed to the elders in heaven and so forth. And I've said in my syllabus, you wonder what the people in heaven thought of an angel so sloppy to lose his report. You wonder if they ever got to read it, all that sort of thing. But he relates it with serious fact, and then he says, I'll tell you how it goes. So he describes the events of this particular fellow. The angel watches over his shoulder. He carries him through this kind of fantasy and satirical sort of way. His satire really comes in discussing the circumstances of life in which he finds himself. Here, for example, the man he's watching over has met a Christian named John MacDonald. Now, John MacDonald is a Christian by profession. Now, this man that he's watching over, J.B. Considine, is just a wicked rascal who spends most of his time looking into racy forms of life. He's young. He's only going to live to be 26, so he's got to get this in fast. He says, I'm not sure that things are as they appear with John MacDonald. I know his guardian well. We once served the courier's elite in Muddy Scuttle. Muddy Scuttle is the earth. Muddy Scuttle's eastern hemisphere together. I am suspicious that Cloud Song knows that, that's the other guardian angel, knows that MacDonald is what our Logos called a hypocrite during the painful years he spent in these wallows. MacDonald's prayers have only an 80-foot radius. His low wattage communication is infrequent as it is weak. Religion's a show, not a way of life to him. Cloud Song told me MacDonald only really played once. His only prayer to make it all the way to human petitions was the one he uttered the night he lost control of his Pontiac on a mountain road. His bumper caught on a tree stump in Upperton, that's heaven, has not heard from him since. Cloud Song probably has no fewer problems than other guardians. They are only different in nature. So he looks at MacDonald. He says there's an unpleasant odor in MacDonald's sanctity. His piety too soon congratulates itself. But at least he is headed for heaven. J.B.'s heading is not so fortuitous at the moment. Every time J.B. swears, which is frequent, MacDonald smugly rejoices over his own moderate speech. Cloud Song tries to warn him against such smugness, but nothing preempts his self-righteousness. You can touch the satire in that, can you not? Of those who, like Pharisees of old, make the great prayers and whose heart doesn't work well. The Valiant Papers go on with that line, criticizing various aspects of the church and talking about real things, too. There's some very striking things in here. There's some believers that stand out in a very firm way and quite nice. J.B. has a love affair with a woman named Cassie. This turns out better in the long run, but he has a love affair with a woman named Cassie, and Cassie is being exposed to Christian testimony of different varieties. Alpha Light, that's Cassie's angel. These angels get good names. Alpha Light told Joymore, another angel, that Cassie sees herself as on the capable. Her petty arrogance dismisses most of her need for our beloved. Her tyranny lies in making God her partner in a faith venture. Like most other positive-thinking Christians, she has two sides, hers and the one which is not so crucial. She has mistakenly felt that the Logos is on her side and is assisting her in a kind of spiritual imperialism to rise to the top of life. She believes that faith in the Logos gives her the right to control others and be successful, whatever devious path she must follow. She's already read some of the numerous books and magazines on the subject. She has therefore heard a score of Christians testify how God exists on the side of our own personal advancement and career. How to be successful, reads one article. Jesus made me corporate head, reads another. Christ gave me the winner's cup and swimsuit competition, reads another. From what Alpha Light tells me, she is still unable to see that her idealism is naive and motto-ridden. Turn your eights to stakes, says one. Another reads, Jesus don't sponsor no flops. And on he goes in that discussion, which you can easily see as a parody of a lot of the things we hear in life as we know it today. Eventually, J.B. in this particular book becomes converted. Cassie is converted. They're quite realistic conversions. Cassie is converted. Eventually, J.B. is converted, and he dies in a bus accident shortly after that. That's why the pavers were left in the terminal. The angel is finishing the last page, and he says, oh, the bus is there. He says, I've got to get that bus. He's got to go too. And he notes in the end, he said that he and J.B. will soon be at the throne. And his last note is, he says, J.B. has run out of time, but he said he doesn't need that now anymore anyway. It's a kind of a striking sort of thing in the nature of the Valiant Papers. Just very interesting fantasy. It's not the sort of thing you have to keep reading. You can put it down rather easily. But an interesting sort of fantasy. And the thing that makes the satire in it so important is that it touches on aspects of life that you know. You must have seen a dozen of the clinics come by on self-help and how to improve yourself and how to make yourself a more glamorous person. I'm not hostile to those things, but I have a sneaking suspicion that Miller, like Swift, just a sneaking suspicion, really has a low opinion of himself and defends himself against these things by pointing out satirically the failures in it. That's just a suspicion I have. I shouldn't even say it publicly, but I won't print it. But it's a suspicion. I might be utterly wrong on it. But I kind of detect, in Swift, there's no question, I'd say. How it goes with Miller, I don't really know. But that's what the Valiant Papers do. They spoof the incongruous things in congruous things, or whatever it is. They spoof the incongruous things in life that you see and wonder about. But they do it in the hope that others will look at them and say, that's awful, and then they'll say, let's stop that. That's what they do in that kind of a hope. In the Philippian fragment, he notes about the gladiators. I may read about that later. If I can stay with one thing at a time. I mentioned then Swift. I would have worked with Swift's Tale of a Tub, but it's really not well known at all. Gulliver's Travels is a little better known, the four books of Gulliver's Travels. And I won't say a great deal about them because they are not primarily religious, but they are religious. They are religious in the societal thrust that ought to be given by church and state. And Gulliver gets into all these things. Gulliver can't stay home. He's got to go to sea. There's a great common plot to all of his travels. He goes to sea, gets wrecked, and winds up in some strange place, and then he cleverly manages to get back home again. He's hardly home, but he wants to go again. After the fourth journey, at the end of the fourth journey, he spends his time on a place where the living rational creature are horses. Hunanims, they're called. Swift comes up with names that you can't pronounce twice the same way, so you do it fast and get it over with. Hunanims, they're called. But they're rational horses. They run the country. They're horses, but they talk, reason, think, act like we do. They have a wretched diet that almost kills him. They just eat oats and fodder. He almost gargles on their diet. And the men in their country are wild, half-animal-type creatures called yahoos, and you just have no good with those things at all. And eventually he's unable to leave there. He stays about 2 years there. Eventually comes home and leaves. But he's enjoyed being with the horses so much that the sight of people make him sick. And when the boat comes to London, his wife runs up and kisses him. He faints. He can hardly take it. He spends the rest of his days as much as possible with horses. And ignoring people as much as he can. Can you see the satire in that? You know, an intelligent animal is vastly to be preferred over the horde of English churchmen and others that are mere pretenders on the surface and are really beasts underneath. A thing that's rational and reasoned. He spends a lot of time, Gulliver does, trying to explain to these other countries how England works. And everything he explains, they say to the other countries, they say, that'd never go here. That never would go there. It's an interesting kind of a thing. Now, like a lot of other people, I read Gulliver's Travels as a boy. It was a boyhood story. We had a shop-worn copy of it. Didn't understand anything about allegory. I just enjoyed it enormously. And that's part of the success of a fantasy. I enjoyed it enormously. And then when I got old enough to comprehend a little of what he was shooting at, then I really enjoyed it enormously. I began looking around the classroom, and I began to see some of my professors, you know, some of my fellow students and teachers. I began to see them in the various roles of people in Gulliver's Travels. Now, the third of these books that I mentioned is this one by Miller on the Philippian Fragments. Oh, boy, it's really an interesting book, and I shan't try to bore you with it too much. It's just full of these satirical things in the life of the church. They may not bother you, but if you think about them, they will bother you. A lot of them will, anyhow. And a satirist is a social critic who sees things the rest of us don't see, so they bother him right away. He tells us at the end of the book, when he explains it, that he was in Baltimore. And Miller is always in some thoroughly believable place. He was in Baltimore at a gathering of archaeologists, biblical archaeologists. And they were going to talk about the Gospel of St. Thaddeus, of all things. They were going to discuss that, but then that paper was canceled and thought he wouldn't even go until he noted that one of the men was giving a lecture on kusiology, a German name, and he didn't really comprehend exactly how to... So he went to hear that, and he listened to the lecture by Dr. Helmut Niedeger. Now, a lot of these names have implications behind them, but listen to Nidiger's lecture, and Nidiger explained how he knew that on a particular island in the Aegean, there was a manuscript from the Diocletian times. He hadn't been able to see it, discussing the life of the church, but he knew it was there. And he felt certain that people ought to get there and see it, but he knew it was there, but he hadn't been able to see it. It's a long, complicated thing, and in a strange way, it's always by chance. They're staying at the same hotel, and he and Nidiger have dinner together and talk together. Nidiger gives him all of his credentials, and of course, as soon as they leave, he wires his church out west, and he says, "Fellas, I'll be gone for a while." He said, "My people understand," so he's quickly off to the Isle of Kos. On the Isle of Kos, he has the fortune to find this monastery where the monks wore out their tongues so they wouldn't speak anymore. Don't speak, you don't say wrong things. The monks there are not able to talk anymore. They've worn their tongues out. There are only 24 of them left. But, it's hard to get new disciples when you can't, and that sort of stuff. But anyhow, he gets there and permission to take it and have it copied and do all sorts of other things with it. And he remembers that that Dr. Nidiger was at a German at Leipzig. He was in the library at Leipzig. He calls the library. They never heard of him there. Never heard of him there. They've got a Niederschiner who cleans the floor. But he wants to make sure the world knows of this, so he goes to the monastery and he stands with the monks. They've got the scroll. He takes pictures of them, takes pictures of the scroll. They do all of these amazing things. He goes down to his room that night, and there's an earthquake. The earthquake completely destroys the monastery, and all the monks are buried alive. The monastery is completely destroyed. All the monks are buried alive. And, of course, the earthquake shakes up the city, and in the confusion, buildings fall, and he leaves. He comes back, and somebody has stolen his camera and all the film. All he has are the little hand notes he made in this manuscript. He said, "Who'll believe me? All the evidence is gone." But Dr. Nidiger, he can't find Dr. Nidiger. He concludes the whole book. He says, "I ask you to answer one question for me. Who is Helmut Nidiger?" That's what he wants to know at the end of the book. But in the meantime, he has gone through a thorough spoofing of things in the church that strike him. And I thought I would just touch on a couple of those things. Although you get started in this stuff and it can go on for a long, long time. Here they're having a crusade. They're having an evangelistic crusade. The Lions are not so active right now. They just left the arena. They're having an evangelistic crusade. Christiana Hausfrau is in Philippi. A German name showed up. Christiana Hausfrau is in Philippi. For only 7 denarii, a Christian receives 3 full seminars and a box lunch. She is popular throughout the empire. Her big seminars are entitled "How to Dry Mop Your Atrium While You Deepen Your Prayer Life" and "How Christ Can Help You Become a Better Mother and Lover." Her supporters say she is strictly dunamis. Dunamis. Next week, the evangelist Silas Scorcham will be holding a crusade in the Colosseum while the lions rest. His most famous treatise is entitled "Severus Maximus, the Antichrist." Those who've heard it are sure that the Roman Senate is the great harlot of the apocalypse. You detect a satirical thrust there, yes. One of the good things about Scorcham is his ministry is supported entirely by free will offerings. They do not ask the slaves to try to be sacrificial for the sake of Scorcham's love offering. After all, it does cost something to buy fuel for the flambeaux and the banners. Besides the many speakers who hold seminars, there have been a lot of musical groups as well. The Happy Romans will be holding a concert on the 13th, and the New Plebeians will be in Philippi on the 20th. Best of all, Lucas New Life in the 3rd chapter of Zephaniah will be here on the 23rd. He says, "I can at last understand what St. Paul meant when he chastised our brothers in Corinth. So many are made neurotic by the fans and supporters of each of these renowned lecturers and entertainers. I am of Christiana, say some. Others say I am of Silas, while others say I am of Lucas New Life." Right now, the Lucas New Life supporters are trying to organize a group out into the concert. And on he goes at great length with that. He picks it up a little later with the conversion of these gladiators, without reading a great deal. These born-again gladiators are a case in point. 1 year ago, upon the Lupercal, Bluto the bludgeon gave his heart to our dear Lord and was, as all said, a convert to Christianity. Bluto stood in the arena and said before all of Rome that never again would he bash any brother except he would give all the glory to his victory to God. From this beginning, he has been crushing opponents for Christ and is always faithful to say that it is only because of his Lord that he is able to be a winner in the arena. He is truly a remarkable athlete. He is to share his testimony before thousands in the Roma Bowl on Ben-Hur Causeway. The problem is that he is charging 5 denarii per seat for those who will hear how truly selfless he has become since embracing Christianity. In this sermon, it is believed he will tell how he vanquished Nicholas the Nubian by piercing him with his own trident, crying, "Ah, Nicholas, see how unbelief can be hazardous to your health." And on he goes with these men who claim to have entrusted Christ but continue living in a very worldly practice. He spoofs a great deal those who have services for hire. I didn't have the courage to write and ask him if he'd like to come and speak and what would his fee be. But he may not have one. He may not have one. We at Biblical don't have one, but we don't need one either. He may not have one. He talks about how the church develops in doctrinal lines, how traditions get started. I've had the feeling that traditions are often a result of happenstance and sentimentality. We must be careful. Have you heard of the figgy ghost? He passes through the city every night, and those children who have lost a tooth may put it on the window ledge, and he will pass in the darkness and exchange the tooth for a fig. The myth is perpetuated by the parents who teach their children and do themselves the work they attribute to the figgy ghost. What in the name of Pluto would the ghost want with a million Greek teeth? Where would he keep them? How much of the poor ghost's life is dedicated to fig picking? Where does a pure spirit find the muscles to lug around a bag of goodies and figs? Well, he works on Figgy's ghost for a little bit. Then he talks about, I'm worried about the Christmas traditions. I've observed them getting started. For the last 2 years, we have had sandal egging. Phoebe detests the tradition and despises the notion that she herself started this one because she lent 2 eggs to her neighbors. On he goes with discussions of that. And eventually he says he can take a lot, but this idea that somebody comes and leaves gifts just by accident, that's a little tough of him. He can hardly do it. The man who is speaking is Eusebius. The man who is speaking is Eusebius of Philippi, writing to his friend Clement. And he's saying, he's in Philippi, Clement is out in Coos. That's how the letter got to Coos. He talks about the persecutions and other things people live. Eventually he really gets sticky on this. He has a chapter with the new discovery and the effectiveness fellowship. Now, I must confess, dear Clement, that I myself have prayed to receive the gift ardently and long, but so far it has never come. The problem is that those who received it wondered my lack of excellence. It is hard indeed for a pastor to live with such a reputation when others have received it. The latest in the congregation received this plateau of spiritual excellence is Dolores of Delphos. Dolores has received the gift. She's been praising God often and loud, sometimes standing in the middle of my sermon and shouting syllables of joy. She smiles constantly, weeps much, and in general has many wishing her gift was still wrapped. Dolores went to a women's gleam group depressed and came back smiling. She has been smiling ever since. Even when she had a fever, she smiled, praised God, and raised her hands till all the bracelets fell to her elbows. Her experience has been a little difficult to understand. It is her praise and phrases that seem to nettle the less emotional brothers and fellows. She blesses God regularly. For instance, she was introduced to the newer church and went with an entirely purpose to say hello. She said, "Blessed God." When she was told of the death of Hiram Presidius, she once again said, "Blessed God." And then he elaborates on the phrases that mark her and other things. Well, in all satire, see, there are some things that you like and some things you don't like, but that's kind of the way it goes. The modus operandi of satire is to pick out that which is incongruous and then to hold it up to ridicule, to humor. And the idea is that the reader will say, "Brother, we need to correct that," or he'll be so disgusted with it that he will no longer have anything to do with it. And so here he depicts the athletes coming by charging 7 denarii to have a big sale. You're supposed to be amused at it, the idea of pay. And then suddenly you get the next week word that there's going to be a seminar in your church on 6 ways to build a Sunday school, only $24 a person with a bag lunch and 2 snacks thrown in between. And you are supposed to remember the satire and say, "What? What? I'm not going to pay $24 for a lecture. My pastor can give me that. We're already paying him." Or something like that. I don't know how all those things are, but that's the thrust of it. And I'm sure that Miller would say there are some things better and some things poor, but that's the thrust of satire as it works in the church and as it works in life. I offer then a short summary on those things. Satire works when you take a debatable subject. See, some people don't mind paying $24 for seminars. Some people don't mind paying $100. I mind paying 50 cents, but I do it a lot of times. There are different kind of things, too. You have to bear that in mind also. But the idea is that the making of merchandise in the church is where he's held up. The debatable subject is chosen, is put into a hypothetical framework. An account is told in the hypothetical that illuminates the actual. Characterizations, real or ideal, are then drawn and given actions on exaggerated proportions. A particular point of the author is set as superior by virtue of the very absurdity of the actions discussed. And so here comes... here comes the big athlete. You know, he's got his trident pierced against the breast of the pagan, and he says, "Unbelief can be hazardous to your health," and he runs him through. So he wars him right on the spot. And you are appalled at the idea that Christianity can work like that. but maybe not so appalled when the next one you run into is a Christian wrestler who tells you how he tied three guys in a knot. You may survive that too. Here's a Christian football player that broke three necks last week. It's one of those funny things in life. So the particular point is set in action like that. Then the account is included with an explicit or tacit observations on what the wise party will do in this case. Clement will die, and Clement will die in the persecution. No, he'll die just before it. Dies of a heart attack just before it. That is Eusebius, I'm sorry. He's in prison at the end of the Philippian fragment. He will die of a heart attack just before he's taken out to be slaughtered and those particular things. But his appeal to Eusebius and to others, or to Clement and to others, is to avoid these things that so distress the church. So, in satire and fantasy, an awful lot is left up to you. That's one of the weaknesses of it. I mentioned in terms of success with regard to them, we note these things. Societal errors are skillfully pointed out. That's my idea. They ought to be skillfully pointed out. Sometimes they're butchered. But the idea is that they're skillfully pointed out, and public opinion is galvanized for action. Now, that's a little ambitious, figure two is. That's what ought to be true. It's a little ambitious. Indignation is the frequent righteous response. The problem is, of course, as I will mention later, that oftentimes indignation is the response, and nothing is done beyond indignation. You get a bunch of indignant people being indignant with each other, little smoke rises, and that's where the action ends. The degree of indication will depend on where the satire is pointed and that sort of thing. Interest is raised in the issues that might otherwise go unnoticed. There ought to be a D on the end of that. Otherwise, it would be unnoticed. The terms in which satire fails are these. A satirist is often content just with the employment of his art. He's happy with the story. He's delighted. He can't believe anybody would miss the point. He writes the story and sits back and chuckles. Novelists write stories and worry. Poets write poems and wonder who will like them. Satirists write stuff and sit back and smile contentedly and chuckle. They enjoy the employment of their art. Never occurs to them that a lot of people might miss the point, but they enjoy the employment of their art. The created works are then often subject, these are terms of failure in this medium, often subject to misinterpretation. The appeal is often one of an elitist sort. A few really brainy guys can get the point. In The Lord of the Rings, I saw a kid reading in the barber shop the other day. There were a lot of people in the barber shop, and so I said to him, I said, how far have you read? Well, he said, I've read the first, his mother was there too, so he said, I've read the first book, and I've read this about half of the second book, and he said, I can hardly wait to get the third book. Well, I said, the third book is really exciting. I said, what do you think is the, what do you think the author is working on? You can kind of see in kids whether they want to talk about things or not. I said, what do you think the author is really presenting? He says, I just think he's hung up on this ring. He says, he's just telling us a nice story about this and how it works. And of course, he's about an 11-year-old boy, I suppose. See, and that's not bad for him. But lots of adults read books like that and see it too. They don't realize that behind that is a satirical concept of the quest for power and how it destroys people. Just kind of miss it. And so that's always a possible difficulty. The appeal is often of the elitist sort. There's a tendency for producers to feel amused at the art, but not instructed in action. So you read about the babies being butchered in Ireland and sold for meat in the streets of London. You say, that's terrible, but you don't do anything. I offer a few observations. Satirists are prone to be thinkers, not doers. They are like scholars. Scholars, on the whole, tend to be thinkers and not doers. I'm not enough of a scholar to be either a thinker or a doer. I'm a non-doer, non-thinker. But that's often the case. They sit and they think. Now, some do, but there's a general rule. They need action men to carry out their programs. It's a general rule. Satirists almost always do. They're busy working on the next satire. Intellectual dissent is not very important if it doesn't lead to social renewal or the spiritual results that they desire. The response to other world manipulations, the fantasy has to be more than just entertainment. It's got to fill you with a feeling of desire to do something. And so we can say that satire is a preparative step in what we are working for. When we evaluate it in regard to Christian truth, I note three or four things. They have proven helpful over the years in some ways. Fantasy is easier reading, but it's sometimes harder to get the point of it because you get wrapped up in the peripheral things about it. And if not used wisely, the satire can become a monolith that destroys everybody that comes to it. And after a while, a person who's satirical all the time gets known for that and has no following in the community. They get weary of that kind of stuff day in and day out. And so what I say is that both tools are effective and not conclusive. Now, I have some Christians who don't like to use either. And I said to them, well, here in the book of Judges, we have a nice allegorical satire with the trees. We have several examples of it in the scripture. with lots of examples of irony in the scripture and a few examples of what I think is sarcasm, but I wouldn't argue with that, but lots of examples of irony, a fair number of examples of satire. Some Christians don't like to use those things, and I think it is because they misunderstand what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to make a mockery of man or his circumstances. They're supposed to alert people by humor to an existing situation which is tragic, and then they ought to have some concept of taking light on it. They are effective but not conclusive. What's needed with a good satirist is a good action man. So that when Swift gets up and gives the proponent on the modest proposal, what you need are two or three politicians to stand up in the House of Lords and say, we've got to do something about it, let's get on. And if the satirists do not have the action people, they on the whole do not achieve the goals that they'd really like to achieve. That doesn't mean they haven't made a contribution, it just means they haven't achieved those goals. And finally, there's a danger that the mere critiquing of society becomes an end in itself. I think that satire and fantasy are both useful tools. It's hard for me to believe that anybody is not blessed in reading Lewis, for example, in his Narnia papers, or even something like The Great Divorce. It's hard for me to believe that anybody is not blessed in some way, blessed is a weak word, helped, encouraged in some way in reading those things. It's hard for me to believe that anybody reading these things wouldn't get some encouragement out of them, and other satires too. And so I'd like to say I think they are a help, but they are not an end in themselves, and they need to be part of the total project. Where you have a satirist working, you need a good theologian working, you need a good exegete working, you need a good evangelist working, so that the satirical thrust is part of the total witnessing operation of the church and not the whole thing. But it can be pretty effective at times. I'm not really good at it in a lot of ways, but I have used it in public occasions a few times when I thought it was pretty effective, and the people who were with me thought it was reasonably effective, but it's hard to say for your own ministry. It's awfully hard to tell. So I'd urge everybody to read Miller's trilogy. It's more in the fantasy line. I haven't read from it tonight at all. I'd urge everybody to read it. I think that anybody would enjoy the Philippian fragment, and if you ever come on Dr. Heidegger, Miller would like to know who he is. I think he's listed in the Taylor's Weekly Book of Prominent Men, but I haven't written Miller yet to tell him who he is. But if you run him, that's how it happens today. But my final note is, what do you suppose Jonathan Swift would have done with the abortion crisis? Abortion is one of the cruelest of all the modern social sins, I think. I can hardly tell you how I feel about it in a non-emotive way. I can just see Swift writing a satire on it. I can see him barbecuing leading abortion persons as baby picklers and all sorts of stuff. I can also see people being scandalized and irritated but still not doing very much. The satirist is part of the picture, not the whole thing. But I think we could use some good ones today in that measure, particularly those who had acceptance in the academic and the social communities, I think. You'll discover that a lot of the satires originally were written, even by good men, anonymously because they felt they would get a better hearing when they came out anonymously because people would not immediately say, oh, him again. Well, that concludes my discussion on these things. If you have a question that I can answer or some point you'd like to offer yourself, I'm sorry to talk at such a rapid rate, but I've kind of learned out of Ibri. Do you believe it? If you have something you'd like to offer or something you'd like to suggest or something you'd like to question, I'll be happy to try to take a shot at it. This is the literary night. This is not the night to date stones. And Ralph will go over the text in a couple of months from now, Mr. Peterson.
You said all fantasy writers deny that they are out of line. Well, is that part of the game?
Yeah. And when I say all, you know, that's a generalization.
Well, they commonly do.
That's part of the game. Because they think if they say they're allegorizing, then people will not be really interested in their fantasy. They'll spend all their time looking for hidden meanings.
So are we to take, when C.S. Lewis says the lion is just something he made up?
Yeah.
Are we to take that along the line of Swift's, you know, final chapter of that?
I would say, in Latin, we'd say, with a grain of salt, cum grano salis. Yeah, that's right. That's what I would say. I think he was a great man. But Tolkien says, no, there's no allegory in The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit. Oh, my. Who is he kidding? And Lewis the Lion just came, you know. It could have been a rabbit. No, it couldn't have been a rabbit. But I think they all protest that because that helps keep people from making a lot of secondary thrusts. I don't think I've ever read one yet who admitted that there was allegory, and I've read a lot of this kind of stuff. I haven't read enough, maybe, but I don't think I've met one yet. Of course, a fellow like John White, he kind of looks for allegories. He doesn't really say it. He hopes you will see it.
Yeah.
The idea is to kind of put one over on the public. Not as, you know what I mean, I hope. Yeah. Dr. Phil.
Do you know when political cartoons became prominent?
Well, I'm sure that
the function a lot in this way as well.
I'm sure that they were prominent a long time ago, but the big impetus came with Thomas Nast in the United States after about 1840. And I'm sure there were a lot before that. We see them in England in Punch in the previous century, in the 1700s. But he really gave it the modern movement, especially with the very apt characterizations of people and so forth. But I mean, my guess is there were probably some back in ancient Rome, too. But really, the form of it as we know it today was really born with Nast, I think. Yeah. Any other questions or comments or observations?
Did you say the Gospel Blimp is an attempt to...
Oh, boy. The Gospel Blimp is a big satire. It is nothing but satire. Joe Bailey died last summer, you know. And I have a lot of respect for Bailey, an awful lot of respect for him. But he wrote the Gospel Blimp, which I think is I enjoyed it. But then about 6 years later, he had an article in Eternity magazine in which he pointed out that satire and sarcasm really did not agree with the Christian presentation of things. And he came by here two or three summers ago, or four summers ago. I think he was by two. Well, he came by one summer. And I had an opportunity to talk with him just for a little bit. I asked him about that. You know, I don't think Bailey really thought the Blimp was satire. I think he did, but didn't, you know. But I think it's a classic example of satire. And oftentimes in his articles in Eternity, satire would roll off the bottom of the page like dew on the grass. I used to read his column in Eternity just to see who he was lampooning, or whom he was lampooning. Healthful satire, I thought. There's unhealthful stuff, too. Yeah. Anything else?
Do you think he was playing a game with you?
I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised, but I respected him a great deal. And I used to write for David C. Cook, then I got good writers. But I did write quite a bunch of stuff for him. And Bailey was there, and he was not my editor, but he was there in different ways. And I respected him for what he did for David C. Cook and what he did for a lot of other Christian friends, too. I think he was a faithful man. But I think a lot of times men like Lewis Arnold, they're not intent, like with the lion, they're not intentionally trying to mislead you. They maybe actually think that, but I think what they do is put up this subterfuge. Maybe they can't see through it themselves, I don't know. But I've never known one yet that didn't. I mean, read one to any degree.
This is probably too strong a word, but where does the border between this satire, almost the concept of blasphemy, of making light of spiritual things, where does the boundary come from?
I like to use the word scurrilous, that when it becomes largely invective or scurrilous, meaning defaming, that then it is passed into the blasphemy sense. That happens sometimes. It doesn't happen nearly as much as you would expect it to. And the reason for that is that satirists on the whole are anti-establishment men, and the only force they can count on for help beyond establishment is some crude deity kind of a concept. But I would say when it becomes defaming of deity or scurrilous, that then it has passed the bounds. And I think it probably will pass the bounds of humor. I don't know. There are some funny things. I think that a thing like Jesus Christ Superstar, I don't think it was satire in any sense. I kind of thought it was demeaning and defaming, but I don't think it was satire. It may have been allegory, but I didn't think it was satire. There was no concept of humor in it to point out the miscalculations. And I didn't. I haven't been exposed to Godspell, so I don't really know how that would go.
But even things like this, the Philippi thing, where he speaks about born again. Well, that's a beautiful scriptural concept. How far can you make light of that and not cross the border?
That's kind of tough. But we've all heard it in our culture in the last few years. Remember, there was a popular song just a few years ago. Had a new lover and had been born again. So we've all heard it in our culture used in non-biblical ways. And I think that's what he's trying to do. Yep, I'd say it's an area you have to be very careful. You can easily speak ill of a truly biblical thing. But we've all heard those terms used abusively in our culture, I think, particularly during the Carter administration. No anti-Carter talks tonight, but particularly during that administration, when born again was almost a catch sign for success. And we certainly heard it with the success preachers, be born again and be rich. We certainly heard it with that. And, of course, that's what he's working on. To some degree, he's working on that. I think that we have to be pretty judicious.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I enjoyed him.
Yeah.
When he's satirical, he's really good, I think. Stephen Leacock, was he a Canadian?
Yeah, professor of economy.
Oh, is that what he was?
Yeah. In Toronto.
He has an ability in a couple of paragraphs to make you laugh. If you can't laugh in a couple of paragraphs, you're beyond hope, I think. Yeah, Stephen Leacock. And I was virtually raised on the humor of Chauncey Depew years ago. Virtually raised on that. My father had a couple of books of his witticisms and stories, which occasionally, again, were satirical. I think the most effective satirists are people who are not satirical all the time. They bring it out and use it when they need it. That may have been Swift's problem. Swift was satirical a great deal of the time. And although he was also very successful a great deal of the time, twice in Ireland he wrote satires that so inflamed the population that they forced a change in British policies. They went all the way over a change for the better in British policies. Once, with regard to goods and shipment, the British had enacted a very unfair, they would take no goods from Ireland, but would only sell goods in Ireland. And so Swift wrote a bitter tirade, a satire on that, and in the satire he made it plain that the persons who were being so affected ought not to give the people any. So he said, everything that comes from England, he said, except men and something else I can't think of. Everything comes from England except men and something else, he said, should be burned. And so for 2 or 3 months, they bought no English goods in Ireland. It just piled up by tons. And then after a period of time, the House of Commons got together and revoked the policy and then accepted Irish goods on a parity with English goods, and trade was recommenced. But Swift rather single-handedly took care of that. And another time when they were working on a devalued money system for Ireland, in his satires called the Drapier's Letters, and he fired the Irish population up, and that's a complicated issue, but he fired them up enough that the English government was forced to make a repeal of those things. I'm not going to get into the Ireland thing, but just can't help but believe if they stayed out of Ireland whenever they went over 1100, if they stayed out, it would have saved a lot of problems over the years. Yeah, Swift, of course, had no sympathy with the Anglicans, with the Catholics, and really did not like Ireland at all. But as long as he was there, he said he was the servant to mankind. He would try to help their liberties. Any other questions or comments, folks? We don't want to prolong it because our refreshments will spoil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.